Hello everyone, we are back. That is right, season two. That means that we've had more seasons than El Dorado. El Dorado.
Setting the sights high.
And we are, for my money, the most listened to disability podcast in the world. El Dorado and the world. Both things we are now bigger than. Take that to the bank. Ka-ching. As always, I am your glorious host, Adam Pearson, mostly made up of hangover and hay fever today, but we'll push through because we're inspirational, so I have been told. I am joined as ever by three very good friends of mine. As always, coming up first, he is the father in the background that keeps the kids in order. Go watch the episode where he wasn't here. It's not great. Simon Sampson, how are you, good sir?
I'm very well, thank you, Adam. How are yourself?
I'm good, thank you. Recovered from surgery. I look a little bit different than I did in episode 6. That's a damn sure.
So, yeah, 100% better, mate. You can't tell at all that you've had an operation.
No, you can't. It's almost like I'm making it up. I'm not, for the record. Let's not go down that route. Let's not go down that disabled people make it up route. My friend, it's good to be back. I have missed you, gentlemen.
It has been. It's been a couple of months since we did our last show. So see, and the first season we got over 400,000 hits, which is awesome. Hopefully, we can do better on season two and try and hit that million mark.
And alongside them, you've already heard from them. We have Mr. Duncan Caswell, who, in our little pre-chat, taught me that there are 750 times more microchips in a car than there are wheels.
It's true.
I know. I don't know where, I don't know, you know, no punchline. I know we're all waiting for it. Actually, a fact.
It's a matter of fact. I've learnt this because my car's been delayed. I'm annoyed. But great to be here. Thank you so much. And I'll apologise to the viewers now if I look a bit different. I haven't had surgery. I just use my contact lens, so I'm wearing glasses. What I call artificial intelligence.
And well, they're essentially the same thing, aren't they? Like craniomaxillofacial facial reconstructive surgery, losing the contact. Like, we're nitpicking at this point.
Exactly.
We are just nitpicking. Finally. Last but not least, if he's not Starsky, he's not Hutch, he's both. That's how good he is. Standing at 6'3", I remembered from last time, he is the best editor in the world. How are we doing, Chris?
I'm very well, mate. I can't take credit for the best editor in the world. In fact, it was Duncan who did the last episode, so... That's why it was so good. So maybe we should share that title. Also, I'm on next gen for my consoles now. I got the Xbox S, not the X, but the S. And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. Have you got a next gen console yet?
I haven't. I'm still waiting on
those. Sorry, mate.
PS. No. It's like, how did your wife react when she found out?
Yeah, I hope she doesn't watch this. Genuinely, I hope she doesn't. I said that I renewed my Virgin broadband, fiber optic broadband, and they basically gave it me for free.
You live in a den of lies.
Wow. I mean,
wow. Risk and reward.
Chris sent me a text last week saying I brought an Xbox, and I don't know if you should tell the wife or not. I'm a bit scared.
I am. It's I have got to do certain things. I mean, it's worth it. It's worth it because I've got away with a lie unless she checks the bank and sees that 260 quid's gone to Smith's toys.
Or watches this.
Yeah. Or watches this. Yeah. She won't watch this.
I'm still waiting for a PS5. I cannot get one for love nor money. There's going to be a PlayStation 8 come out before I can get a PlayStation 5.
I did find one, and it was £750. Oh. And I laughed, and I walked out of the shop.
Was it secondhand?
No. So I also think it might have fallen off the back of a lorry.
Wow. That's incredible. It
was absolutely in CEX.
Yeah, every time. They want silly money for it, and I refuse to pay that because I know that I'll find one the week after that's new, and it will be, what is it, 450 quid? RRP?
Yeah.
So,
nearly half the price. Also, when the company's name is Sex, like, doesn't mean you've got fuck people.
It's ironic because it's only virgins that work there, isn't it?
Hi! If you want to sponsor our podcast. So, now that's Manchester and CES. Not really alienated. Let's crack on with the podcast with our recurring segment. I don't know what we're calling it. Is it stupid questions? Is it dumb questions? Do we revamp it? The series 2? Who cares? Chris, what do we have?
Oh, that was the intro. I thought we were having a conversation and a debate before we filmed.
This is going to take a long time.
Okay, we'll stick with stupid questions, all right? We'll stick with stupid questions. First one.
Hitters.
What is the most ridiculous fact you know? I can't believe I wrote that. After Duncan's, there's 2,000 microchips in a car.
3,000.
Three?
3,000, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
are we sticking with that fact? What is the most ridiculous fact you know?
I know that there are only 3 words in the English language that begin with DW.
Okay.
I can't even think of one.
I'll give you a clue. I think Warwick Davis.
Dwarf, dwindle.
Dweeb?
And Dwilly.
Dwilly.
Happens on a summer morning.
Morning glory.
Yeah.
DW.
Dwell. Dwarf, dwindle, and dwell are the only ones that begin with DW in the English language, in the dictionary.
Don't worry, I'll fact check that after the episode.
There'll be a long list. Just scrolling.
I've met Simon in person. I know that he gets things wrong a lot. So I don't know what you mean. let's move on to Adam. What's the most ridiculous fact you know?
The most ridiculous fact I know is
Want you one mastermind? I thought you'd have.
Yeah, yeah. That's like this fact.
With my help.
You essentially.
Were you in the audience Simon. Copying Simon?
Sign language.
Tom Hanks was not the first choice to play Forrest Gump, and it was actually Robin Williams who turned it down.
Really?
Wow.
Mm.
There you go.
I will fact check that as well, but that is a very, very, very good fact. Duncan, are you sticking with microchips or are you...
No, I would say that this, the most random and pointless fact I know is that the average human hair is stronger than its equivalent thickness in copper wire.
Eh? Really? Really? Who knew that? Exactly. Wow, your beard must be fantastic.
My beard could spend the Sydney Harbour Bridge. It'd be great.
Okay, we'll move on to the second stupid question. What's the weirdest thing you've seen in someone else's home?
Yeah, I'm just trying to... Oh, I'll tell you what. I'm going to name drop here. Yeah.
Really?
yeah. So I've been in some really, really fantastic homes, and... About a year ago, I was at Lord Spencer's house, at Althorpe House in Northampton, as you are. He's got a fantastic car collection. And I had a quick chat with him, and his wife has got some very unusual art. And when I say unusual, absolutely freaky. So one of the paintings that was in the hallway, which we had a nice chat about, and they have to remember, this is Harry's and William's mother, aunt. And what it was a picture of Jesus Christ with a lot of men surrounding him in bio outfits. You know, those like chemical outfits that you get? Hazmat suits. So it was Jesus Christ on the cross with his arms out, surrounded by men in biohazard suits.
When I was about 13, 14, there's a guy I was at school with, and we'd been, a group of us just invited over to his house for a movie night or something like that. We'd all trundled over. Never been there before. He was quite an odd bloke at the best of times. We walked into the front door opens, and there's just this artwork straight in front of the front door, which is him arse naked sitting on a piano that his mum had painted. Okay, I've never wanted to leave anywhere so quickly in my life. We were all trying to think of ways we could just get out of this thing now. It was the most bizarre thing I've ever seen.
Did he approve of it?
He
was like, oh, look at this painting. Or was he like, don't look at the painting as you're walking past?
No, he was very much like, yeah, my mum did that.
With his arse out?
Yeah, not just his arse. We're talking the
wow.
Okay. And she wasn't kind.
Oh God, that's a weird relationship they've got.
Oh man.
Okay, well we'll move on to Adam. What's the weirdest thing you've seen in someone else's home? Say Simon.
Simon's dungeon.
Cocaine. Cocaine. Yeah. I interviewed this crazy person on the Joy of Teen Sex, like a Channel 4 sex ed program, and they legit had a sex dungeon. And it was weird. It had like a cage. It had like a crucifix. There was like gallows, like, the dungeon from Aladdin. It was like that, but slightly kinky and very scary.
Which instrument hurt the most?
The cat o' nine tails is not fun.
50 Shades of Adam Pearson.
What I want to know is how you wandered in. Were you just, I need to use the loo, and I took a wrong turn and suddenly I'm in this sex dungeon, or?
No, we were filming it. We were there for the sex dungeon. We were wrecking a venue, is what I was told.
And that's the end of the stupid questions this week.
So, my topic, and even for me, this is a weird one. There's an event happening in Newcastle. I believe it's the 26th till the 31st of October. So the Halloween period, to all intents and purposes, called Dinner and Dissection. And it's an event where they're doing almost like a faux autopsy of the Elephant Man in a big circus tent and serving dinner at the same time. And the companies that are running it, they're on Dragon's Den, they got money from Deborah Meaden, and I'm confused because they're advertising it as like a educational event aimed at people who are interested in studying or are already studying anatomy. But on the other hand, it's an event at Halloween with booze, food in a big top in Newcastle. And In my head, I can't reconcile those two things.
The whole concept of eating while this is taking place for me is... I'm genuinely speechless. I can't...
I'm reading the stuff on the internet from this Dinner and Dissection, and it says tickets include admission to the show of the Elephant Man. So what this poor chap who had this horrible disability similar to Adam, was... preyed on by everyone who's world renowned for having a huge disability. Okay. And now they want to recreate his body so they can dissect him. I mean, this is a human being at the end of the day. This is a person. Okay. And to go along with the dinner and dissection, it's a fully heated, carpeted, big top, state of the art audio visual technology. So just in case you can't see it, they're going to beam it and explain it even more. Live dissection of real specimens. Well, he's dead, so you can't do that. Work with questions to our clinical team. Now, I want to know what kind of clinical team would actually do this in a big top tent, which looks like it's a Dumbo exhibition.
I think it is, but I think worse is that, that this is happening, and everybody agreed that it was wrong, and it, the modern-day freak show. You can't do that. What's worse is that they're blanketing this event as educational. No one believes that. No one. This is a medical university. These aren't trainee doctors going along to see what you do. This is people going along to a modern day freak show to
profiteering.
To eat. I can't think of anything that worse than to put me off my appetite than seeing a dissection. I can't get my head around it.
Yeah. Oh, just to let you know, there is plus authentic Victorian sweet shop. And a merchandise store, so you can go and buy stuff that relates to the Elephant Man.
Well, yeah, and why is it Halloween? And why is it in Newcastle? Why not have it in Leicester, where Joseph Eyre was born? Or why not have it at the Royal Victoria, where he was treated and lived, and where he and Frederick Tree spent a lot of their time? And none of this adds up. And also, it's at Halloween, which then creates or gives the impression that disability and disability is somehow scary or villainous.
Yeah.
And there's just so many negative stereotypes that ultimately they can walk away from. They can pack up, walk away, go home, and not have to deal with it again. Whereas I don't have that luxury. I don't have to carry those expectations on very broad shoulders. And it sets my work back years. I then got to do this whole damage limitation thing.
Yeah.
So I've got to say, hey, actually, a lot of that was A, medically wrong, B, historically wrong, and also very Victorian and vaudevillian. Here's what the modern day experience of living with a disfigurement is actually like. And then I've got to go through this weird phase of justifying my existence. Not in a circus, right? It's almost like, I also think that the man, Joseph Merrick, deserves better. We are kicking off series two with a cracking interview. A young gentleman by the name of Bobby Shunley, who is a racing car driver, and he's also autistic, hence we thought, let's get him on. Let's have a chat with him. I mean, I'm not going to talk to him. I know nothing about cars. I'm like the worst person to talk to him. However, Duncan and Chris have my back on this one. So, gentlemen, take it away.
Thanks, Adam. And I want to thank, absolutely, Bobby, thank you for joining us, mate. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I'm doing great. Thank you.
Fantastic. So, the reason this has come about is that earlier last week, there was an episode of The Tonight Show, which was focused on hidden disabilities. And one of the key figures in that episode was Bobby himself, who is actually a racer. And I was completely in love with the car because he drives an Aston Martin, which if my drinker, that's what he's got. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to reach out. And Bobby was great. And said, yeah, I'd love to come on. So here we are. So how did that episode come about? How did you get approached?
Well, we got a team Brit. Obviously, I race for a race team called Team Brit, which is one of the leading teams. Well, it is the leading team in racing for disability people with disabilities, physical or mental. So for me, I was actually part of the team. I was one of the first civil people because it used to be injured war veterans. So we had a driver called you might have heard of him called Martin Compton. He got blown up and his face is all burnt, bless him, and everything. And he used to be part of the team, and also his friend, who was an army friend called Warren, who actually got me in.
were they? I think it was the Grand Tour, or no, it was Top Gear. Were they on Top Gear where they were looking at doing the Dakar, wasn't it? And they had the Land Rover.
I don't think that was them. No, that's a completely different thing. But yeah, but this is
four veterans, and I was putting two and two together there. So
it's fine. It's absolutely fine. But yeah, so basically, Team Brit's grown massively over the past couple of years. So. Yeah. So we started off, well, when I joined back in 2018, I joined and I started racing with them in 2019. We only had a couple of cars. And
the thing that got me was that you guys, you don't restrict yourself to disability, though. Whilst all your drivers, you guys race against fully able-bodied teams.
Exactly. It's not
in a special class. It's just, you just get out there and do it.
Exactly. So we got drivers who are paralyzed. So my teammate in the Aston is actually paralyzed from the chest down. His name's Aaron Morgan. So he uses, I may as well use a demonstration. Excuse me for a second. This is not how the hand controls are. I'm just borrowing, stealing something from my sim. So if we imagine, that these pedals here are like, so the steering wheel's here, circle, obviously. This is like a Formula Room, so it's different.
Yep. Yeah.
But that could be the throttle on the hand control, and that's the brake. And then we change gears using like the buttons, like rockers on the steering wheel. So that's how Aaron drives the car. And if I wanted to, or anyone can drive the car. So we got a guy who has the use of one arm. So he caused a motorbike accident. And then we also have a guy who's can't use, for example, he can use his left foot leg. But he can't use his right leg, and he uses the hand control throttle, but he uses his foot for the brake, and you can mismatch, so we don't have to adjust anything in the pit stops. That's
incredible. The engineering in that as well. And it's amazing to see the acceptance, because this isn't just, go into a car and drive away. This is making all these modifications to cater for drivers. This is amazing. Bobby, how were you introduced to motor racing?
So you'll like this.
Okay.
So when I was about 8 years old, I went to a go-kart party in a place in Woodley. And if you don't know, Woodley is a place in Berkshire, blah, blah, blah. And it was a party, and I went in there and I didn't like the environment. Where I'm autistic, I had a sensory overload. I didn't like the smell, the environment, the noise, the crowds and everything. So I literally ran out of the building crying. And one of the kart guys, the owners of the track and family, because it was a family run track, came out and managed to convince me to come back in when everyone was having their lunch. And literally, once I first got in the car and I put a helmet on, I felt like I was in a happy place, because it was the first time I felt actually in control of something. Mm. So, and it was like a little release. And as soon as I went out on the track for the first couple of laps, I was just like, you know what? This is absolutely mega. I really love this. And believe it or not, that's when I first won my first race. There was a race at the end of the party, and I actually won that first race. And
amazing.
I came through... From then, I'd started doing work with one of our sponsors, Daytona Motorsport, and who, funny enough, sponsored me now. So I used to race in their in-car championship in 2010, and then I progressed through there. I did have a running owner driver karts, which are what I raced was 125 Rotax Max engine karts, which for a person at 13 or 12, so 12 is a class called Mini Maxes, where they do about 15 miles an hour. And then I moved up into junior Rotax before 2013, and they do 75 mile an hour. So at that, and with your backside literally that close on.
Yeah, I know. When you're in a go-kart doing that on those tight tracks, that's not slow.
No, I got big respect. I got big respect for those guys who race the gearbox ones, because they do 160.
Wow.
I need to have a go in one.
Well, you tapped on something there that I really cottoned onto when you on the show, and that was that you see being autistic as actually it's an assistance to you. It actually helps you with the racing. How's that work for you?
So obviously being autistic, I have my moments. So I so for example, I'm quite dyspraxic with my hands, but also I can be a little bit shy. I'm not very confident sometimes. And also I don't really, not nothing against people. I don't like speaking to people that much, you know. No, but no, I don't mind on like Zoom calls, but in person I struggle because it obviously you're speaking face to face, and I sometimes look up in the sky and just think, oh, wonder what this is. That a light bulb? What manufacturer is that? But to answer that question, so obviously autism has its disadvantages, but my advantage with it is when I'm behind the wheel of a car, I'm able to focus on so many things, and I'll probably be able to register so many more things. So, for example, I'm sure you know Silverstone, and you've got, let's just say where Hamilton and Max Verstappen had a little kiss. So, for example, if we were going it through cops and into Maggots and Becketts and through that section, and I was in a battle, or for example, I was able to analyze. So a normal driver would just turn into the corner, hit the apex, go for it, you know, register, like, all right, I've got a position in the car here, apex, exit, focus. Whereas I would calculate, seem to take in more information. So I'm able to go into the corner, and I'll probably be like, right, okay, so there could be some fluid here. Okay, I see a tarmac change a little bit. Okay, there's something over there. And I can pick this up in milliseconds. And I'm able to calculate the inputs on the steering wheel probably as well through the corner. Mm. But especially in a battle, I'm able to make these last minute decisive moves. So if most people would just I'm able to make last minute decisions probably a little bit quicker than most people have, not to sound nasty or anything. But it's like I'm able to make these last minute decisions, and I feel that it's like a little secret weapon to me.
So it's almost like your reflexes are just sharper.
Mm. Well, it's not just that, it's just like my head's working a lot quicker.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're analyzing things that others don't take into account.
Yeah.
Others do, but not as quick as you. Yeah.
That's amazing. I have got a couple of questions because my son, he's 8 years old, and when he finds something, he has this whole obsession. He doesn't stop. And one of the things that he has got into is Forza.
Of course.
And he knows, I think, the 762 cars. He knows them all. He's driven them all. He's got millions in his Forza bank because he just doesn't stop playing. So he's really into racing. So his first question is, how much does it cost to get into racing?
Well, it depends, really. It depends how, obviously, where you start and also and everything. So personally, if you were wanting to start and getting involved in racing, obviously go-karting. That's where it all starts, you know. It's hire karts. So let's say for Daytona, you can like Bambino stuff for 7 to 8 year olds, and then you can jump into a cadet kart, which is a 40 mile an hour go-kart. And around, let's say, Milton Keynes, Sandown Park or Tamworth, and they're Daytona tracks. I'm just going to use Daytona as an example because they're kind of
sponsored. I'm not sure. Trust him going 40 miles an hour. I don't trust him on his push bike. Never mind.
Can't
you do us a favor? I'll cut this bit and say that racing's rubbish and you wish you'd never taken it up, so he just gets off the subject. It'll save me money and it'll save him time.
No, but there's also other options as well. Obviously karting, if for that age, obviously karting is the way to into motorsport, and also way into getting behind the wheel, you know, at a young age. It could also help them in karting as well. It teaches them the driving technique, which they can actually, believe it or not, take it on the road. Obviously, don't be it like a boy racer, but it gives them the fundamentals to be mentally prepared to go on the road. Yep. But if you're, let's say, our age, my age, or your guys' ages, and you want to get into racing, and you want, either you can start in go-karting, hire karting, or you can buy your own go-kart and run it, which I don't recommend. It's a lot of money. Let's say some people, this is what owner drivers like. You get people who buy chassis, new chassis every 3 meetings. You get people who have a quali engine, a practice engine, and a race engine. And it's thousands of pounds. You get
that's racking up the tens of thousands there, isn't it?
Let's say a go-kart chassis standalone is about $2,500-$3,000. Yeah. An engine is about £1,000, depends. You could get a tuned one from, let's say, Strawberry, for example, which is a Rotax builder. They retail their engines about $2,000.
Wow. That's he's got a three-part question, this one, and he's going to watch this because he's a fan as well. You race, so he's always going to be a fan. The question he's got is, what's the fastest speed you've done? Where was it? And how did it feel at the time?
Right. So the fastest speed I've done is at Silverstone on the hanger straight coming down the back straight. And it was 165 miles an hour in the Aston Martin. And traveling at that speed, it's not the speed that is really that fascinating. It's applying the brake and going through the corners at a certain speed. So obviously at the end of hanger straight, you've got the corner that goes into the Formula One loop. That corner, you're braking hard and you're going around that corner in a GT4 car, so you haven't got that much aero, at about 80 mile an hour. You're braking from 165 to 80, and you're getting the car in and you're fighting the car all the time. That's the bit that's thrilling. Obviously, traveling at the speed, everyone loves a bit of speed. We all do. But it's fun. It's a nice feeling traveling at that speed, but obviously you've got to register it all. But I feel like cornering, braking, and that is probably more exciting. Mm. But also when you're in a fight, wheel to wheel at 150 mile an hour down the straights and entering the corner, who's going to break first, last? Who's going to have the bigger gojones, as they say?
That's huge. I guess that's where you're fighting the, you know, centrifugal forces and the G forces, and
exactly.
That's where you're fighting for control.
Mm.
At the speed, it's not just a straight line zoom, it's actually how fast can I make this without losing control. I can imagine that's a real rush, to be honest.
It definitely is, especially when you've got your engineer speaking to you halfway around the corner, you tell him, shut up. Sorry, Al, I love you.
That's how we talk to Simon. That's fine.
And Mr. Sanderson, you look like you're itching to say something. So what's on your mind, good sir?
So for this episode, I'm trying to raise awareness for local authorities and understand how desperately needed disability officers are required. And we're not talking about disability officers who go around and give you, you know, assistance during social services, who provide carers and things like that. I'm talking about when a person becomes disabled or has a disability, where they can actually turn to for assistance. Because I did a little bit of research on this, and I wrote an article about this about a year and a half ago, and nothing's been done. And it's a mind-boggling field. There's disability living allowance, there's child maintenance support, there's housing benefit, there's PIP, there is attendance allowance, there is... council tax benefits, there are council tax discounts, there's social services care, children's care, adult care, social care, daycare centres, motability schemes, employment support allowance, access to work, you know, then you need, social services assessments, you need physical assistance, you need to go to age concern or scope, and the list of agencies that you need to approach for help or care or whatever is a minefield. Okay, now I worked in social services for years at Leicester City Council, and when I became disabled in 2014, I never heard of the motability scheme. The motability scheme takes away your part of your personal independence payments so you can get a car. I never knew this. I never knew that you could get hand controls for a car. And I was in social services. And I'm trained. I'm qualified in adult mental health and physical disabilities. And I never knew hand controls existed. You know, I've never come across them before. And it's what you need to know when you need to know it. And there are no schemes. There are no officers. There are no people out there who can say you can get this, and put it in a big folder for you. Yeah, to tell you what is needed and how to go around and get it. And this is why I mean, I think it's vitally important that local authorities introduce services like this. And I'll give you one example. I used to work in a team called the Income Management Team, which was to help people who were in arrears with money on their rent at Leicester City Council, which not to say the majority of them were. And what they did, they introduced a financial officer who would help you manage your rent and reduce the amount of debt you owe to the local authority for renting that property. Why don't they do the same for a person who approaches social services, which happens almost on a daily basis, yeah, for thousands of people across the country who now have a disability, and say, let's approach a one-stop shop at your local authority and assign a person who can talk you through the process and help you through the process of applying for all these benefits, all this assistance that you are going to need eventually.
It's a really good point. It is. But
yeah,
do you think this is intentional? Do you think it's a minefield intentionally so people don't get the money that they're entitled to?
I think the way the system is set up is not helpful either. So, for example, is if you live in Leicestershire, where I do, you've got I've got a parish council, a borough council, and I've got a county council. Okay. On top of that, I also need to approach DWP for benefits and working pensions and so on and so forth. So I've got four authorities there who I am in constant contact with all the time. If you live in Leicester City Council, it's a unitary authority, which means it's just a one place. You only have to go to Leicester City Council. You don't have the three boroughs. And I think the whole system is set up so that it is difficult to approach, and people just don't understand it. This is not what is taught at a school level, unless you go to university. And so I don't think it's done intentionally. I think it's the lack of involvement and engaging with the disabled community and councils not responding to the needs of their communities.
I'm going to go Grandpa Simpson on this and say, I think it's a little from column A, a little from column B. I think there is deliberately complicated because it stops people from making claims on benefits they're entitled to. And I think the problem there, and I've spoken about this a number of times, because it was my own personal experience. So I'd always worked. I've always been in full-time employment. I paid my taxes. I've done it all. Before I became a carer, I spent 3 weeks in my entire life in unemployed. I've never had to claim unemployment benefit or anything like that. When I became a carer, I was basically forced into it. I was told by, you know, social services that I needed at home. You need to do this. And I had to shut down my business and become a carer. And I was talking to a chap I bumped into at a National Trust property, funnily enough. And I was just chatting to him. He had a daughter who had Down syndrome. And we just got talking, and I said, funnily enough, I just had to become a carer myself and sort of explain the situation. And I said, and he said, how are you coping with it? And I said, I'm really struggling. I've always worked. I've always, you know, contributed. And I feel now I'm sponging off the system and I don't like it. And his comeback to me was, and it turned out, this is the irony, it turned out he was my old boss's father-in-law. So it was, I had no idea talking to the chap, but he said, look at it this way. Would you go back to work tomorrow if you had the opportunity and it was safe to do so and you know, everybody could still be looked after? Yeah, absolutely. Of course I would. And he said, how much do you think it would cost to get somebody else in to do your job that you're doing as a carer now? I don't know. As I'll tell you now, it's at least 10 times what you're getting paid. And my involvement, I've become a carer's ambassador for Devon Carers in the last 12 months. And I had a radio interview a few weeks ago when I was on, and part of my preparation for it was, how many billions of pounds do you think are saved by carers in the UK doing the job they do? How much do you think it saves the government? Because I'll tell you now, it's £132 billion a year. That's saved. You know, we're not smooching off the system. We're actually saving the system money. And there's this underlying sort of thing of, if you're claiming benefits, you belong on TV shows like Benefit Street and stuff like that. So, I mean, the advice I always give is get straight to the Citizens Advice Bureau, because they will do a good job of going through all that kind of stuff. But I completely agree. I think there needs to be someone centrally in council. But the problem is, council don't want to spend the money. They want to save that money and not get that money spent.
Yeah.
And so it's counterproductive for them in many ways. But it's so needed.
One of the most watched videos on Ability Access Facebook page last year is I did a video explaining that if you either have, if you're wheelchair dependent, or you've got an adapted room in the property, or you've got a medical room that you need to use for whatever reason, okay, you can actually get a council tax band deduction. So, you know, if you're in tax band C, D or whatever, you go down to B and A. And we got hundreds of messages on Ability Access saying, how do I apply for this? And people, and some councils put a cap on it, some didn't, but we didn't. And we got back £4,000, because they backdated it to 2014. Okay. And some people were going back 10, 15 years where they were getting tens of thousands of pounds back from the local authorities because they had been overcharged because they'd been disabled for 20 years. And it just goes to show that people don't know what they can claim and don't know what they're entitled to under the government system, on the local authority system. And that's just a prime example on why I think disability officers are desperately needed in all local authorities to help people who are disabled as much as they can.
Who does this fall on, though? Who does this fall on for the change? Is it local authorities? Is it the disabilities minister that literally does nothing? Is it the prime minister?
Yeah. I was reading about the disability minister this week, and he's employed like 10 people to the disability team who none of them have disabilities.
he's a piece of work, isn't he? I can't name a single thing he's done except put out some very empty, heartwarming tweets, but it's all a song and dance with nothing behind it.
It'd be like asking the four of us to work for the National Diversity.
it doesn't make a lot of sense, but I mean, who does it fall on? Who does it fall on?
For me, I mean, local authorities can choose to employ disability officers at this stage, but also, you know, the community ministers and the local authority minister can also say, put a thing out there saying, look, we're going to install or do temporary installment of disability officers who are going to help people to identify what they can get. I mean, we're talking about the basic things here, like even assistive technology, like where, you know, people need big remote controls where they can't see the buttons on the TV, or to big clocks or talking clocks or medication dispensers or whatever. It's basic primary things that are needed in daily life that people just don't know they can get through their local authorities.
There's no awareness, though. This is the biggest issue, is the people in charge of making these decisions, they've no idea what the disabled community go through. So when it comes to that, they've never stepped a single step in the shoes of a disabled person. So it's nowhere near the front of their mind. Going back to the disabled minister, he has no idea, and he could be spearheading all of this. As Duncan said, as a national standard, he should be banging down the door for this, but he's so far removed. What has he done?
I always thought it was a good idea to live in a wheelchair for a week. If you're going to be the disabled minister, you get yourself in a wheelchair for a week and see how easy it is to get around London. And I can guarantee you will raise 1,000 issues within a week on how to improve access for everyone.
Yeah.
It's a basic social experiment, even if it's for the afternoon. Yeah. Go to the toilet, you know, go out and get a cab, go and take the tube, just go around London and push yourself in a manual wheelchair and see how you get on.
Well, series two started off a little bit heavier than I thought it was going to. I'll be honest. So, Chris, if you could lighten the mood, that'd really help me out. Like, really help me out.
I think it's just going to be for us because everybody's tuned off now. They're depressed with what we've talked about all through the show. I'm just doing this for us four.
But it's like the end of this episode.
I've got a corker anyway. Here we go. So, escaped python bites man's genitals after hiding in the toilet. An Austrian man sustained an eye-watering injury when he took a nibble to his genitals. 65-year-old felt a pinching pain, stood up, and found the snake still attached.
Great balls of fire.
It belonged to his 24-year-old neighbour as well. He didn't even realise it was missing.
But he's got a bit of snake bite, hasn't he?
Mr. Victor, don't you know?
Feeling that pain, standing up and being like, oh, God, me, that's grown. Oh, no, wait.
I don't remember it being scaly.
Gentlemen, it's always been a pleasure, and we will see you all episode 2. Remember, better than Eldorado.